All boats are aligned. Attention.
Welcome back to the Weigh Enough Podcast with Short and Snarky Rowing. We're your hosts and masters of ceremony, the Short and Snarky Coxswains. I'm Sam, and as always, I am joined by my co-host, Kate.
Thanks for tuning in. This week, we've got a great episode. We're going to be talking to the world-famous author and one of the coaches, rowing coaches at the Groton School in Massachusetts. You may know him as Dr. Rowing. It's Andy Anderson. And if you haven't checked us out on social media, we're at Short and Snarky Rowing on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.
Yeah. And since we have such an esteemed guest and we're honored to have him, we're not going to do a news story today, so we will just get him on the line.
All right, Dr. Rowing, how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing great, and thanks for giving me a call. I look forward to talking with you.
Thank you so much for agreeing to be on the podcast with us. We're not worthy.
Yeah, really, say that a couple more times.
Well, I'm squeezing you in between, you know, my multiple TV and social media engagements.
But, oh, absolutely.
It's worth it.
Absolutely. So we just had a couple of questions for you. I know that we kind of talked briefly. If you could just give us your background in rowing, like how did you get started and up till now?
All right, very good. I started in high school. I was 14 years old, 5'4", 89 pounds, and I'd always played baseball, and, you know, I could see the writing on the wall. There were much bigger, stronger kids who could throw the baseball much harder than I could, and a friend of mine in my dormitory said, "You should be a coxswain. I'm going to be rowing this spring, and I bet you really like it." And I remembered that my dad and my godfather used to take me to watch races at Princeton. And so I kind of had some idea what that was about. And I thought, great, why not? You know, here's a team that wants me. So I started coxing and immediately liked it a lot, especially once I had my first race. Then I continued coxing throughout college, although I started growing, and so by my senior year in college, I was 5'11", but still managed to keep, like, under 130 pounds. I think my senior year, I was 5'11", 124.
Wow.
And really, really
I know,
funny.
And I just can't even imagine what I looked like. but I do remember my college coach one day looking at me shivering with shorts on and in the boat, and he said, "You know, I think next year we're going to start having women coxes. I just can't stand looking at your legs." And they must have been pencil thin, you know, although I can't find really photos of myself like that in those days. Of course, cameras were not as omnipresent and so on. I'll try to speed up the history here, but anyway, I thought after a brief introduction to the banking world, I thought, you know, it's all right, but what I really want to do is be back out on the water. So I started, after 1 year away, I started coaching in college and liked it a lot, and just luckily had some really good, talented kids who I learned a ton from. And we had some early success, and, you know, I thought, this is great stuff. And then I started coaching in clubs. I came to a high school. I coached for the national team for 10 years, and now I'm back full-time at doing high school coaching and teaching, by the way. But,
oh, cool. Okay.
Anyway, so that's how things got started.
Well, Dr. Rowing, as you know, Sam and I are fledgling authors. We're not really authors, but we tried. We'd love to hear a little bit more about the origins of the Dr. Rowing column and how you really came up with the idea and got it published and going at the beginning.
Sure. Well, so I remember it really well. I was in 1994. We had a boys' crew go to Henley in England, and unfortunately, I think made a mistake. We entered the Cox 4 event, which no high school ever does well in. It's like way too competitive.
Right.
But we had a really good high school 4, and we thought, well, let's give it a try. Unfortunately, we lost in the first race to guys who ended up being semifinalists, and I think our time ended up being the fifth fastest in an event of 32 boats. So, you know, with a little luck, we could have done better, but we lost our first race, and so there's a lot of standing around time. And I was talking with a couple friends who coached at Princeton and Columbia, and somehow the thing just came up of, like, great rowing stories. And I said, you know, the one I've always wanted to know about, which I heard when I started coxing in high school, was about the Japanese 8. And the story, as it was first told to me, is in the Olympics, and it was unspecified which Olympics, but in the Olympics, there was a crew from Japan, an 8, that rowed so high, like in the 50s,
wow,
that at the end of the race, two guys died right at the finish line. Another two died on the dock, and two more were taken to the hospital and almost died. And I remember at the time in high school thinking, that is awesome.
Yeah.
A sport where you could be so intense that you might die. And of course, I was a coxswain, and I had no worries of dying.
Yeah. Of course not.
But I thought, you know, this has got to be, there's no way it's true, but how is it that it's such a widespread story? And I had heard it from several people, from kids I coached, from all kinds of people, and I thought, you know, I'm going to look into this. So I did some research and found out that indeed in the 30s there had been an experiment in Japan, because their people are not as tall.
Right.
They decided that in order to make this work in the sport of rowing, they, A, used smaller equipment, and they actually had some smaller 8s built, and they had shorter oars, and they rowed higher. And a couple people saw my original column, which was, I wonder how this story got started, and I wonder what the truth is. And they wrote to me, among them Hart Perry, a bigwig in U.S. rowing, and Joel Burke, who was the who held the Henley course record in the single scull for 20 some years. He's a guy from Philadelphia who had coached at University of Pennsylvania. They both wrote to me and said, you know, we remember seeing a Japanese crew at Henley in 1935. Who did row in the 50s. And so I dug into it a little more, got in touch with some people in England, talked to people at Henley, and sure enough, there was a crew that would start in the mid-50s.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, for close to the first 500 meters, and then they would bring it down, but they never got below 40. And they won their first race at Henley, and then they lost to somebody who won the Grand Challenge Cup, so no slouches there. Then they went on to a race at Marlow, which is only like 1,400 meters, and they rode the whole race above 50.
Wow.
Now, so that part of the story was true. However, none of them died.
Oh.
And, yeah, oh, what a disappointment.
Well, I was going to say, I can't believe I'm cheering for no death, but
right. But anyway, then I had a chance to coach in Japan, and I asked some of the older Japanese oarsmen, you know, if they had heard this story, and they were like, "No, what do you think that means?" And you know, of course, I didn't want to say, well, we Americans think Japanese people are crazy or something like that. I just said, I have no idea what it means. It's just a kind of wild story. And I was introduced to somebody who had rowed, at that point, had rowed in the 36 Olympics, the ones that are now famous because of Boys in the Boat.
Right.
Japan did not make the finals of that, but they had, sure enough, that, you know, that was just 1 year after they had been at Henley. And in 36, they did row most of the race in the 50s. And I talked to this fellow. And anyway, so that got me thinking, what other good rowing stories are there?
Yeah.
And, you know, I compiled a short list. It was kind of four or five things. And I thought, okay, well, this will be fun to write about. And the U.S. Rowing Magazine liked my column, and they said, you know, I don't know how much material you have, but why don't you write for us? And I did, thinking, like, you know, I have four or five good stories to tell. And it turned out that there are a lot more stories than that in rowing. And although now I don't write only about sort of legendary, wild stories, I do all kinds of things about rowing. So it's now been 22 years, and I don't seem to be running out of stuff at all.
No, yeah, I was going to say, you've got, so when did you start, writing with that?
Oh. Well, so I started writing in 94.
Oh, okay.
And then I'm a little hazy on the date, so about for 3 years, maybe 4 years, I wrote for the U.S. Rowing Magazine, which now there isn't one, but
right.
There used to be one. It had various names, American Rowing, U.S. Rowing. And then they were having budget problems, and they said, you know, we're not sure we're going to be able to keep this up. Maybe you could write once a year. And at that point, Rowing News, which is now Rowing Magazine, actually, it started as Independent Rowing News, but
yeah.
Now it's just called Rowing. They contacted me and said, you know, we love your stuff. We'd love for you to write for us. And so in about 98, I started writing for them.
Oh, cool.
I'm probably dating myself here, but I do remember the days when you used to get a magazine with your U.S. Rowing subscription. So,
Right. Well, I think now actually you do again. But
yes.
What you get is Rowing Magazine.
Right, exactly.
They struck a deal last summer, and it's great because, you know, I think you ought to get a magazine if you are a member of U.S. Rowing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
Right. Well, you know, that's really great. You know, we've sort of cut our teeth learning to write on our own and kind of self-teaching ourselves here. So we're always really curious to hear from people that are doing it right and doing it well and have been doing it for a while. So it's really nice to hear that side of it.
I'll just return the compliment a little bit. Last year, I reviewed your book, which you were kind enough to send to me.
Thank you so much for that.
It's really good stuff. And, you know, I don't know how many books about coxing the world can support, but
yeah.
Yours is a good one, and we use it here. We have bought a copy, you know, for the boathouse.
Thank you.
And it's good.
Thank you so much for that. We'll send you your check in the mail for commenting us on that one. Thank you so much.
Right. This podcast has about the same number of subscribers as The Moth, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
Cereal, right?
Yeah,
up there.
So I know, yeah. I'm talking to hundreds of thousands of people here.
Oh, absolutely. So here's a funny question for you. What is the craziest rowing thing you've ever seen?
Craziest. That's a good one. The craziest boat I've ever seen, and I've never seen this, I didn't see this live, is probably a tie between, you know about the famous Russian coxed four, where the coxswain was in the middle?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, now I have pictures of that actually on my Dr. Rowing Facebook page.
Okay.
And it's pretty amazing to look at.
I think that's
and
what
the
I
story behind it is that the Russians were experimenting with syncopated rowing, which is, you know, in theory, I guess, physicists say that the way you would go fastest in rowing is to always have some oars in the water,
yeah,
not drive recovery. And so the Russians had a four built with the coxswain in the middle. You know, the problem is you couldn't do that without the oars hitting each other in a conventional boat. But so the bow pair were going to be catching right as the stern pair were releasing from the water. And so instead of, you know, everybody in sync, there would always be two oars in the water. And apparently they did a little bit of racing like that, and it was just way too hard for the rowers. They chose a women's cox four, which in the old days there were many more opportunities for coxswains. Now we're down to the eights, but and you know, it was just too hard to do. Although I guess it moved along fine, and so they still had this boat, and they took it to the World Championships in 1979 at Bled, I believe, and somebody I know took some pictures of it and gave them to me. And, you know, it's amazing to see, although they are rowing, you know, normally, but still to see a coxswain lying down in the middle, absolutely unable to see anything at all, is pretty amazing. The other thing that's just a crazy boat, and I think it's the University of Western Washington did this about 5 or 6 years ago, they actually raced a boat where it was stroke 7, 6, and 5 were all port, and 4, 3, 2, and bow were all starboard. Have you seen a picture of that?
Yeah, I think I've seen a picture of that. That, I don't know, just haven't seen.
I can't think of any good reason why you would want to do that.
Yeah.
You know, I think conventionally everybody thought something like that would either snap the boat in half or twist it or something like that.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
I think those kind of unconventional rigs are fun to see. I don't know if that fits into crazy.
It fits, I think.
Yeah, that works for us.
Okay, well, I will tell you, when I coached in Japan, my first day on the water, there were over there, and I guess for the, what are we up to? So not 2004, what am I talking about? Not 2016, but aren't the 2020 Olympics going to be in Tokyo?
I think that's right, yeah.
Yeah, I think the 2020 okay. Olympics are going to be in Tokyo.
Well, they're not going to use the course that they had in 1964, which is at a place called Toda. And they're not going to use that because it's notoriously windy and the lanes aren't fair. And they want to be much closer to the city. It's kind of a hour outside the city by train. So I was out at Toda, where they have probably about 12 boathouses, and all the colleges, the kids live in the boathouses, and they row there, and then they take the train to class. I was out there, and in the mornings, there's a river right next to the race course on the, there's sort of a steep embankment, and you can climb down and go on the river. And the river, offers, instead of going back and forth, you know, on a constructed course, you can go for miles on the river. And so we went over there, and we're driving along, and I was in a launch, and there are these oil tankers that come up the river. And I don't know if you've ever seen a fully loaded oil tanker.
No.
But it's kind of like an iceberg, where 90% of it is underwater. And so this looked like a very small ship approaching us, because I don't know how many feet stuck out above the water, but maybe it looked about 10 feet tall. And so I thought, okay, well, it's not such a big deal. And the coxswain started sort of panicking.
Yeah.
And he stopped, even though I hadn't told him to. He stopped, and he did exactly the right thing. He turned so he was parallel to the wake that was going to hit them. Mm-hmm. And there were like 10-foot waves coming off this thing because it was fully loaded, so it was just heavy as could be. And the waves start taking this eight, and there I am, like, thinking, oh, my God, I've got these guys in a terrible situation. And at one point, it's riding the wake, and I looked out, and I could see daylight under the shell.
Oh, my God.
It's like, yeah, it's like 10 feet off the surface of the river.
Oh, no.
On top of a wave, and you could see under it. And I thought, you know, I don't know what the legal penalties are for killing 9 oarsmen, but here I am, an American coach, no idea what I'm doing at all over here. I can't speak Japanese.
Yeah.
They're all going to die. And luckily they didn't. And you know,
okay.
The coxswain had been really good and knew exactly what to do, and they all laughed at me and said, this happens all the time.
Yeah, okay, because I was going to say, if you're confessing to 9 murders, perhaps this part will be edited out of the podcast. All right. Well, that's good that they didn't die. That is, wow, that's a crazy story. And then our last question that we ask everybody, and I'm sure that you heard, is, do you still have all of your rowing medals? And if so, where do you keep them?
Boy, so the medals I won as a coxswain, I guess. Yeah, I guess I do have them all. I think they're in the top drawer of my dresser.
Okay.
More important to me are the medals when I was coaching the lightweight women's national team. You know, a bigger deal was the medals that we won at world championships. And I think they probably do the same thing now, but in the 80s when I was coaching the women, they would give, the athletes got a medal to wear around their neck on a ribbon, mm-hmm. but there's a large medal, kind of the size of like a butter plate, good-sized medal, that they give to the federation. And at some point, U.S. Rowing just got sick of having all these medals sitting around in their, you know, closet or something. So they gave to the coaches these big medals. So I have 3 FISA gold medals, a silver, and 2 bronzes. And those, like all the rest of my rowing paraphernalia, those are in our downstairs bathroom.
Oh, that seems fitting.
That's a really good place,
a place to put all your hardware. Well, yeah.
Exactly. Well, it gives people something to look at, I guess.
Yeah.
But, and I guess that's where my 2 Head of the Charles medals, which were hard won, you know, as a coxswain, those are down there too.
Excellent. Well, that's cool. It's a really good spot to put them.
Excellent.
Oh, yeah.
And, admittedly, we do have to hop off here, but we do appreciate the conversation with you, Dr. Rowing. You have amazing stories, and we can't wait to share them with everyone.
Yeah, and we'd love to have you back on sometime.
Absolutely, we'd love to
talking.
All right, well, Mark, can I ask you and your readers a question that I'm trying to answer myself?
Sure.
Do you have time? A moment for that?
Absolutely.
Okay, so one thing that many people have wondered about, and I just got a letter about this recently, was where does the tradition of throwing the coxswain in the water after winning a race come from? And, you know, I think it's pretty easy to imagine why it developed. You know, people are excited, they're happy, and they think, hey, what better thing is there than to throw my coxswain, this guy who's been screaming at me for 8 minutes or 6 minutes or whatever, why not throw him in the water? And, you know, every coxswain I've ever known, and certainly I was like this, I loved being thrown in the water.
Oh, yeah, it's the best because it means you won something
although
big.
Some people think it's sort of cruelty or, you know, hazing, I would say absolutely not. Those people know nothing about rowing.
Yeah.
But it was done, certainly it was done in the U.S. as long ago as about 100 years ago. My British friends say, well, it's done here too, and we know that they say always done it in the Oxford Cambridge race. And I said, really, always? Like, so that's 100 and what, 160 years old? And I say, well, maybe not always, but for a long time.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering if anybody listening has any friends that are, say, 150 years old or something who know the origin of this. I would love to hear about it.
Absolutely. And I mean, it could maybe go with the old throwing the baby away with the bath. I don't know. But thank you so much for your time, Dr. Rowing. Hopefully we can have you back on sometime soon. And we look forward to seeing you out there.
All right. Excellent. Thanks very much. And good luck with your own writing and your podcasting.
Thank you so much.
All right. Yep. Very good. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
So that was Dr. Rowing. I mean, really fascinating. I mean, it seems like he's lived 10 lifetimes.
Oh, my God. Absolutely. Those were great stories. I really enjoyed that. I'm glad to hear that we didn't have a bunch of Japanese rowers dying. So that was very nice
to
hear.
On either occasion, in the Olympics or in one of his
absolutely.
Practices.
So short and snarkians out there, you heard, you've been tasked. Where does the throwing the coxswain in the water after a victory come from? So that's our homework for this week. Or just in general. I don't know. We don't have a deadline. Let's just do it in general.
I'd love to know.
I love it. Yeah. I love being thrown in. You guys love being thrown in. You love throwing your coxswains in. So follow us on Instagram and Twitter and
Facebook too.
And make sure you pick up our book.
We're at Short and Snarky Rowing, and you can pick up a copy of our book on Amazon, and you can find us on social media. Thanks for tuning in this week.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys, and we will see you on the water.
Last two strokes. That's one, two, way enough. Let it run. Blades down.